White Flag Games is proud to present the Lore Forge podcast. We discuss world building, lore, and literature theory for the purpose of helping others create great role-playing scenarios. My name is Joe McNeil, and I'm the producer. On this episode, we'll be discussing Jeffrey Cohen's Monster Culture Thesis, Part 1, an introduction and an overview.
I'm Isabella Rock. I'm a folklorist. I recently graduated from Indiana University with a degree in folklore and ethnomusicology, and that encompasses a lot more than you might think, everything from fairy tales to internet memes, so it'll be interesting.
I'm Solomon McNeil. I am also a DM here at White Flag Games. I've been around for 12, 14 years, but I've been both a player and a DM myself. I've used many different systems, so I hope I can bring a couple different perspectives.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Parker. I've been playing D&D for about 10 years now. I've been a DM and a player, have a lot of experience in it. I'm probably going to be the youngest out of this group as I am 19, but I will have the most imagination out of all of them.
So our topic we'll be covering right now is monsters, specifically from my teaching on the monster theory of the seven thesis of Jeffrey Cohen. And I think it'll be an interesting discussion to not only see where monsters come from, but how they can be utilized in different types of stories. So first, let's start off by saying, like, when you first think of monster, what is like the quintessential monster to you?
I would definitely say like something ugly or fearful, but ugly is the immediate one that comes to mind. Anything that's just ugly, people will automatically consider like a monster.
A lot of times I think of some sort of challenge or some sort of force to be dealt with or reckoned or feared, some sort of not only a living creature itself, but sometimes a symbol as well.
I think it's interesting that as someone who's only played D&D once, I don't know how much this is actually utilized in the vernacular, but I've heard that any creature you might encounter in D&D is called like a monster. Is that what you would use usually? Is it just like anyone that is different from the player character that's not an NPC?
Sometimes there's a lot of different types of monsters, but they're all considered mainly under the umbrella of monster, yes.
Yeah, a lot of times, usually there's a difference just between PC, the player character, and then the NPC, the non-player character. But usually the non-player character is what encompasses just all of it. Usually the only difference between what you think more so of an NPC of being like, oh, this is just a civilian in a town or a merchant or whatever, between that and then like, oh, this is a savage monster who roams the world or a dragon in a lair or whatever. Sometimes it's really just down to their intelligence and whether or not they are more thought-provoking than just, I am an animal and I eat, I sleep, and I just live off instinct. But there's a lot of different ways they're depicted in the different systems and stuff like that. But I feel like most of the time, the way that monsters or creatures are taken from literature are just like, what are the common things that vampires do or are weak to? Like, oh, so if you use some weapon that's made of silver, or if you stake it in the heart, or every time it dies, it goes to its coffin, that kind of stuff. That's usually what they take from it.
Yeah. And that's one of the things about folklore is that any type of story, any type of being will transform over time. It always has to have variations. So from like a perspective of storytelling, that could happen from story to story, from game to game, anything like that. But one of the main theses of this article that I find interesting is the idea that the monster is a specific product of its culture, and how no matter what monster it is, every time that it appears, it'll be in a specific time and place in that cultural moment. So like the different transformations of a monster in a story can be used to highlight different fears of anxieties that we have in culture. So one of the main things that I wanted to bring up is, how would you utilize that when telling a story? Would you be mindful of that going in and try to highlight a specific fear that people might have? Or does that happen more naturally?
If you're trying to highlight the monster being monster-esque, you probably would want to find out what first actually makes it a monster. Like if it is just because it is ugly or has tentacles or something like that, and the tentacles freak people out, then really emphasize that, like a tentacle comes around a corner or something like that and breaks the wall, like showing its strength and its creepiness. But yeah, I think you'd want to do that.
I think that the different way you kind of portray it beforehand sometimes helps if you maybe build it up in the form of this was a quest that they went on to go slay this monster versus we were escorting this caravan down a road or whatever, and this thing attacked the caravan. So it's different ways that the monster can be built up to seem either more of like a threat or more of just like, oh, this is something that just lives in this dungeon that I'm delving right now, or this tomb that I'm exploring. And I think another thing that helps that is a lot of times as a DM, you have to really describe the situation. I know a lot of people nowadays do tend to use a sort of minis aspect, like on the map, and you get to place the model on the board and kind of like scare your players, like, oh, look at this thing, it's huge. But sometimes something that may or may not be lost is the description you can put into it with your words of just being like, this thing invokes terrible fear, and you feel a sense of dread as you look upon its thousands of eyes and horrible yellow teeth. Or you could just be like, oh yeah, this big bear-like creature turns the corner, roll initiative. And it's like you can really put the level of how much you want to make the players care about it based on how much you care about it.
That's true. And you could also make it more or less scary depending on how, like, if it's ever going to show up again, you probably want to make it a little more scary. If you think it's not going to ever show up again as you're running the game or as you're telling a story, then, I mean, yeah, you kind of want to make it scary, but you don't really have to as much.
I think that's an interesting comparison between like, that's something that we would call like the sublime kind of, is something being so awe-inspiring or so terrifying that you have to like take a step back and both like appreciate its horrifyingness and also you feel like small in comparison. It feels like a big obstacle. So it's really satisfying when that can be like overcome in a game. But there are some that have argued that the D&D manual or other types of RPG manuals having a specific like set of statistics for every monster takes away some of that fear you might feel as a player. And personally, I think that even though you might be able to metagame, even if you might know all the statistics and weaknesses, that you can still do things to feel something. So what are some tips for any type of like storytelling or running a game that you would have to make sure that that feeling still comes across to experienced players?
One thing I know that I've utilized to help build a specific thing's more pertinent threat, or to make it seem like maybe this is a not just a monster, maybe there's more depth to it, like maybe this thing is acting differently than normal and maybe proposes like the players either like subvert expectations and try and reason with it, or if it's normally something that's placid, they would be like, oh, we should probably kill this guy. But I think a couple things usually help it. One major thing that I like implementing is the actions and convictions of the monster itself. A lot of times you can have something like a lich, just a high-level necromancer kind of thing. It's found in multiple fantasy-esque RPG systems, but I think the most notorious part about it is like, oh yeah, this guy raises things from the dead, but he's also a really powerful wizard on top of that. I think one big thing that people like to know about the lich is like, oh, a lot of liches have this thing called a phylactery, where they siphon parts of their souls into objects or other people or just in places in general, and they spread them out to prolong its life. One big example of it is Voldemort from Harry Potter. Even though he's not like a lich, quote unquote, he has the same kind of element that liches have always had in their use of spreading themselves and trying to prolong their life. Obviously, Voldemort himself lived way longer than a normal person should, and that was because he utilized a lot of dark magic, which is what liches are seen to have. There's a level of like, oh, this is a lich. He's just kind of like using dark magic in a selfish aspect of like, I'm trying to just make myself live longer because I want to be immortal, because that prolongs my life and I don't have to die and end my life here. It can stop there. I've had a couple times where I've utilized a creature that was a lich, but because of his actions and the things he did outside of just trying to prolong his life, the players and even other people in the like setting had more of a reason to go find this guy, go defeat him. The guy was like forming experiments on people, trying to create new ways to create undead creatures and minions at his disposal and stuff like that. And a lot of people refer to him as like this taxidermist lord, where he was just like making these awful abominations of like just dark magic and stuff like that. And that caused the players to be like, okay, this guy is not just like selfishly prolonging his life. He's actively killing more and more people than he needs to. He's putting some dark influence over the realm and spreading this dark magic, and it's causing the quality of life in this realm to get worse and worse and worse. And the difference between that and just this guy who's selfishly just trying to prolong his life changes dramatically, of being like, that was a lich, this is the villain of the story.
I have a lot of thoughts on dark magic and stuff like that. But first, Isaiah, do you have any other thoughts on like making things still feel monstrous, even if you like know the metagame aspects of it?
Two things. One, statistic wise, is that if you're as a player in any game, you can always know that whoever's running the game can change those stats. So I try to always forget about the stats whenever I'm a player, because I don't know, that they could have just made a frog for some reason have 1,000 HP, who knows? But secondly, though, a way that you can make a monster more monstrous is, in the beginning, not even making him a monster, making them maybe like a friend of the party, which is what I've done multiple times, is I will make a friend of the party slowly but surely turn against the party, and maybe even try to convince another party member to go against them, kind of making it that they're a monster because they're a traitor.
Interesting.
And that really, even if it's just a fairy, for instance, it really makes the party despise them. So they might not be a monster in that way, but they're definitely an emotional monster. Now they want to kill them or get revenge.
Interesting. I like that idea of like there's both physical monster from like how you look slash your actions that you do yourself, but also monster in like a societal sense of like you have turned against them and betrayed them. And it's, yeah, that's super cool. So my thoughts on the dark magic type of stuff is mostly in storytelling, I would say that dark magic is always seen as something bad or evil. And mostly it seems that from the type of media I consume at least, it seems to be that dark magic is in some way using slash hurting other people, using life essence for selfish gain potentially, or somehow affecting other people to a degree where they can't control themselves and are just sort of like your minion at that point. And all of those aspects are something that could be seen like as monstrous. And I think that that's interesting, especially because dark magic technically is still magic, which could be used for good. But everything that goes into it is somehow against the moral system of the world that you're either playing in or writing in, that sort of storytelling aspect. So one of the things that makes me like wonder is, could there be a system or a game where the dark magic itself is not monstrous? Or do you think that's so baked into our culture right now that when you see that, it's kind of like flags go up of, oh, this person might be evil?
No, I think there's plenty of ways that are usually implemented in a lot of game systems I've used that are like, for instance, there's a lot of like classes, usually what like the players pick as the basis of like creating their character in a game system. In things like D&D, there's the warlock. Pathfinder calls it witch, and it's normally seen as like this is a spellcaster who uses a lot of taboo magic of like some of these things are like labeled dark magic of being like, oh yeah, this guy can use mind control. He can spit balls of acid at people. He can contact a dark entity to bestow him physical power for a limited time, stuff like that. But the player himself and the character is using those powers, but usually they'll use them for good. I've known very, very few campaigns that it's like the players are the bad guys in this story, and you guys are doing the bad road. But most of the time, the players are supposed to be the good guys solving a problem. Not every story has to be they're saving the world from calamity, but a lot of times it is on the good side of the spectrum. There's still other campaigns that are like, this is more neutral, where it's like, oh yeah, you guys are like going to commit a bank heist on a whatever. And that's not primarily evil. It can be evil. It can be like, oh, I'm going to hold up all the people in the bank and then we're going to kill them on our way out. It could also be like, oh, we're going to hold up this bank, steal all this money because we know the rich corrupt baron owns all this money, and then we're going to Robin Hood style bestow it upon the poor and stuff like that.
The only thing I want to touch on though is you said like taboo magic and whatnot. And I wanted to ask, why do we think taboo things are bad? And also, why do we as a culture mainly consider taboo things like monstrous mainly?
I love that question. So one of the things that taboo might mean is things we don't want to talk about because they are like a little too scary. So for example, talking about death in a really open way is pretty taboo in Western culture. Talking about things like sex, pretty taboo. Not because it's scary, though, but another reason could be because it feels uncomfortable. It's like potentially like unknown, hard to discuss. You don't know how to talk about it. So the two sides of that and bringing that into dark magic could be that in a culture that is set up in a game or in a story world, is that dark magic is seen as taboo because it's more mysterious, or because it's using things that people don't want to talk about. It's dealing with death, necromancy, any of these sort of things. You mentioned like liches and Voldemort and how the breaking apart of a soul is something that is seen as dark magic. That could be potentially taboo because it's so different. It's so against what you can do normally to a soul or understanding of a soul that's seen as something sacred, perhaps, that it feels wrong. It feels taboo. You don't want to talk about it. And when it does threaten you in a way, then it becomes scary.
A lot of times in using that kind of magic of like, oh, I'm splitting my soul and using these phylacteries or whatever, a lot of times that's also synonymous with like, oh, I'm spreading apart my soul, becoming immortal, and by becoming immortal, you become different from your fellow man. Because for instance, like Voldemort and a lot of liches are just like they started as a mortal being, but the more they utilize this dark magic, the more they turn into this immortal creature that's no longer a person, and then they see themselves different from other people, and usually the more they lose their soul, the more they lose their empathy towards their fellow man and stuff like that, and that causes them to either become angry towards each other, or sometimes a lot of liches just see mortals as like, oh, they're just ants beneath my boot. I don't care how many I have to kill to get my immortality. It's nothing. They already live short lives compared to mine, so I'll end it by a couple years. It's nothing to me.
And bringing that back to theory for just a moment, I think the lich is a really great example of how the monster always escapes theory can come into play, because it has both the in-game, in-universe aspect of even if they are defeated, quote unquote, there's a potential they can come back. But also from like a cultural perspective of liches and this type of idea of someone who breaks their soul apart, such as Voldemort, can come back into culture during times when you're perhaps uncertain about, the boundaries between life and death. What will you do to achieve a longer life? How far will you go? How monstrous will you become? But also this theory of, what's taboo and what's a good way to phrase this? Of not only what makes us afraid, but of what makes us feel like the boundaries between human and monster can be blurred. And that can come into what is referred to as category crisis of, you know, human versus non-human or evil versus good and all of these like dichotomies. Whenever the lines are blurred there, it makes us feel uncomfortable. It makes us feel like a little afraid. And so by using these opposing like factors in a monster, even going to things like a werewolf, for example, between man and beast, it makes us confront the idea of, oh, not everything that exists in this world can fit into neat little boxes. So other monsters that might do that would make you feel afraid just from their very existence. So, monsters of that nature that are already pretty scary, what other things can you do to enhance that in the story, to bring out those opposing qualities?
So, one thing is that you said the category crisis and whatnot. If you can somehow make it, what is the word that, like, it's almost looks human, but it's not?
Uncanny valley.
Yes. If you can make that monster like an uncanny valley type, it would make it a lot more spooky, a lot more monstrous and things like that. That's what I would say, is to make it more monstrous, kind of get to the uncanny valley area, or like the category crisis, as you said, to where you're not completely sure if it's a monster.
Yeah.
I think one thing that also adds to that is a lot of times humanoids, things like elves or dwarves or whatever, sometimes they're like, oh yeah, it's like they're good and whatnot, but a lot of times they're described as like, oh, it's human-like, it's close, but it's not the same. Something like an elf is like, usually they're, and I'm talking about like more of like a Tolkien-esque, like elf, tall, beautiful, pointy ears, yada, yada. A lot of times they're described as like hauntingly beautiful. And it's like, they have this weird aura about them that's like, they're kind of a person, but it's, they're different in some ways to us, but in a way they're so similar that it's just on the brink of, are they a person? Are they a human like other humans, or are they like something else entirely? And whereas most of the time that elves and dwarves and stuff like that, they're just like, oh, they're just more regular people. Most of the time they're good and whatnot. I think that's a small portion of like that can add alienism to like the other races and stuff like that. I know a lot of people love to imagine the rivalry between dwarves and elves, how they're the two opposite sides of like a human from each other, that they don't like each other in some weird rivalry aspect, that they always are at each other's throats for no other reason than they just look like each other and they have different aspects about them.
And that bridges perfectly to the theory that, or the thesis, excuse me, that is called the monster dwells at the gates of difference, where anything that's different between a group of people and another means that it could be scary between the two groups. So mostly this theory is talking about a more outside of the story quality. So it could be anything from like political differences, cultural differences, race, economic status, and all of these different types of like societal implications. But in a story, these things can be either really obvious in the storytelling, or it could be more subtle. So one example potentially is the evolution of why, quote unquote, why, you know, there are many reasons, but why Dracula has appeared in different movies throughout the years. So this is not just my idea. Definitely like a lot of people have theorized about this before, written academic literature about it. But I do think it's really interesting that in the original movie with Bela Lugosi in the 30s, it was fear of like an outsider coming in that has like a lot of charisma, a lot of like suave qualities, a big house, being able to like take over and prey on the weaker people of a culture, the women of a culture, from an outside perspective. And then you see, like, in contrast, the movie that Coppola did in the 90s, and how in that case Dracula is still the same monster that you know from folklore, But the different emphasis in the story, especially being placed on like the blood and the gore throughout the film, and how much is shown of like transformation through blood, that as a product of the 90s, it could be interpreted to reflect cultural fears of AIDS having come up and, you know, disease or different things transferred through blood. And then all the way to Twilight, and I've never read Twilight, only watched the first movie, but people will say how Twilight is a vampire story that is instead not about like being preyed upon in a sexual nature necessarily, but it is about kind of like, you know, abstinence in general and how the monster in that case is a form of desire, which is another thesis, but it's still seen as something monstrous, even though that theory that, oh, you can be attracted to what makes you afraid because it's so compelling and interesting. Differences in vampires over time is something that I think is very interesting. But any monster can have all of these different like types of cultural differences.
Thank you for listening to the Lore Forge podcast. Join us next week as we discuss more on Jeffrey Cohen's monster culture thesis. This was recorded live at White Flag Games in Mooresville, Indiana, produced by Joe McNeil, featuring Isabella Rock, Isaiah Parker, and Solomon McNeil. Theme music by Alex McNeil.